Kia ora and welcome to Good Fellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by an unrestricted educational grant from Mercy Ascot. The content of this podcast was developed independently and the views expressed are those of our expert speaker. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, a specialist GP, and today I welcome to the podcast Dr. Parry Singh. We're discussing common anorectal conditions, including hemorrhoids, perianal hematoma, and anal fissures. Parry is a colorectal and general surgeon who practices at Middlemore Hospital and the Colorectal Centre in Auckland. He completed his medical degree and specialist surgical training in New Zealand with a further overseas subspecialty fellowship in colorectal surgery through the Colorectal Surgical Society of Australia and New Zealand. Through this experience, Parry has gained expertise in managing a wide range of colorectal conditions, ranging from complex problems related to colorectal cancer, inflammatory bowel disease, and diverticular disease, to the more common and troubling anorectal conditions such as hemorrhoids, anal fissures, and fistulas. This comes with an experience in a range of advanced surgical procedures, including minimally invasive techniques such as laparoscopy, as well as being accredited to perform colonoscopy and the removal of polyps. Kia ora, Parry, and welcome to the podcast.
Kia ora, Louise. Thank you for having me.
So let's start with hemorrhoids. What are the features in a patient's history that could be concerning with respect to hemorrhoids?
So hemorrhoids, I guess the first thing to say is a normal part of our anatomy. So everyone has hemorrhoids, and it's usually a surprise for people to hear that and patients to hear that. But I guess it's important to understand the anatomy and how that links into patients' symptoms. So hemorrhoids refers to these normal vascular cushions that we have within our anal canal, and they have a function and contribute to maintaining our continence. Roughly about 10 to 15% of our continence is due to these anal cushions. And it's when these become symptomatic is when they are termed hemorrhoids. And these symptoms can vary, most commonly bleeding, but also prolapse symptoms where they prolapse out of the anal canal. That can lead to discomfort and pain. It can lead to some minor incontinence and mucus leak, which can then give rise to pruritus and difficulty maintaining anal hygiene. So those would be spectrum of symptoms related to hemorrhoids. And often patients will present to their primary care health providers with bleeding or prolapse symptoms, or feeling like they've got a lump that comes out with passing bowel motions or unable to keep themselves clean down there.
So during a physical examination, what findings are we looking for, and what findings would be of concern when assessing for hemorrhoids?
Sure. So I guess a history before the physical examination is key to anyone who presents with anorectal symptoms, and the history can often guide what the diagnosis might be. And we'll discuss perhaps some of the concerning symptoms in anyone who presents with rectal bleeding. But if someone is complaining of bleeding, prolapse symptoms, then on examination, things start with a good external perianal examination to assess for any obvious prolapsing lumps. There may be skin tags and loose skin around the anal verge, and retraction of the buttocks and viewing the anal verge to actually look for things like an anal fissure, which is a common cause for painful rectal bleeding, is very important. The integrity of the perianal skin itself may also indicate if people are having to wipe very excessively, and seeing excoriation and skin reactions may also give you an indication of their underlying problem. And then once you've done a good perianal inspection, starting with a digital rectal examination is key. And the old adage of if you don't put your finger in it, you put your foot in it is very true. And missing someone with a low rectal cancer or a concerning anorectal mass just because you haven't been able to do an adequate PR examination is sometimes very disappointing. So after the inspection, a good digital rectal exam. And then in primary care, access to doing a proctoscopy or rigid sigmoidoscopy would not be very widely available. But if you had access to an anoscope or proctoscope, then that could be done to assess for any prolapse or any large internal hemorrhoids prolapsing into the proctoscope as you withdraw it. Those would be my suggestions for a overview of a good examination in this regard.
Perfect. Thank you. So I just wonder if you can talk us through the grading system for hemorrhoids, please.
Sure. The grading system for hemorrhoids goes way back. It's still used to this day, and it's graded 1 to 4, with grade 1 being hemorrhoids that do not prolapse, grade 2 being hemorrhoids that prolapse but reduce spontaneously into the anal canal, grade 3 being those that prolapse but the patient has to manually reduce them themselves, whilst grade 4 are those that are just continuously out or remain prolapsed, and even if patients try to push them back in, they're just falling out again. So whilst examination can tell you how large or how prolapsed hemorrhoids can be, the feature of whether they fall out and reduce, whether the patient has to push them back in, is based on your history. So assessing that on a history is also important to actually seeing what symptoms the hemorrhoids may be actually causing the patient.
So Perry, thinking about management now for a moment, I wonder if you can talk us through the general advice you'd give to someone presenting with hemorrhoids, and then perhaps discuss more specific management, thinking about grade 1 to 4.
Sure. So the management of hemorrhoids is, again, there's quite a few facets to it. And I often describe to patients that it's a stepwise approach, with the first step and the basic step being diet and lifestyle measures. And the basic advice that should be given is patients should be trying to eat healthier, eating less processed food, higher fiber diet, and having more fluid intake to ensure they're having softer, more regular stool rather than hard, firm stool, which is more likely to increase pelvic pressure within these vascular cushions and lead to the development of hemorrhoids or making them much worse. In addition to that, patients may have long-standing issues with constipation and rely on laxatives and other supplements to kind of help keep things regular. So addressing things with their diet is crucial as the first step. And things like physical exercise and ensuring they remain active contributes to maintaining a regular bowel habit. So that would be the first step in the management of hemorrhoids, regardless of whatever you do as surgical options. After that, it does depend on what symptoms the hemorrhoids are causing the patient and how large the hemorrhoids are. For patients who present with painless rectal bleeding, which is often due to internal hemorrhoids that aren't necessarily grade 4 or permanently prolapsed and remain internal to the anal canal, then often we will discuss rubber band ligation of hemorrhoids as the next step. This aims to really create a mucosal scar just above that vascular cushion to try and pexy up the vascular cushion and reduce the vascular congestion within it, and thereby reduce its size and its tendency to bleed. In contrast to what often diagrams of rubber band ligation will show when you Google that online, the bands themselves don't actually go around the hemorrhoid like you're docking a sheep's tail. It actually goes above the hemorrhoid and above the dentate line, so that you're getting into an area where you don't have somatic pain sensation and therefore are less likely to create discomfort for the patient. Despite that, banding can still cause discomfort and a degree of tenesmus, where patients feel the urge to go to the toilet. And in some patients, that can be a very uncomfortable experience, particularly if the bands are put too low and close to the dentate line. Rubber band ligation would be a common clinic-based procedure that's done for hemorrhoids. And if patients are agreeable to that and understand that they may have a few hours and 24 hours of discomfort, then that is something we often do as the next step. Injection sclerotherapy is also an option for internal hemorrhoids, and that's variably used in New Zealand, more widely used in other places around the world, which works by injecting a sclerosing agent into that vascular cushion to try and achieve the same effect, essentially, as banding, by creating scarring and reducing the inflow and size of that vascular cushion. Once you've explored those clinic-based procedures and have patients who haven't necessarily had a durable outcome with those, you may have patients who have much larger hemorrhoids that need surgical management. Some patients do benefit from repeated rounds of banding, so they may need two or three banding procedures to try and achieve a wider mucopexy effect and then get over their symptoms, whereas others, particularly with very large and prolapsed hemorrhoids, have hemorrhoids that need to be excised with a surgical excisional hemorrhoidectomy. Another surgical procedure is suturing the hemorrhoids by suturing above the pedicle and reducing the inflow of blood into them, in the same effect as banding and sclerotherapy, but done under an anesthetic without necessarily excising the hemorrhoidal component. And that's shown to be associated with less pain compared to a excisional hemorrhoidectomy, but perhaps not as durable an outcome for the larger prolapsed hemorrhoids, which just need to be excised. So those will be a rough overview of the management options for hemorrhoids as you go up in grade and size.
Perfect. Thank you for that. Just wonder if we can go back a bit and talk about topical treatments, because that's often what we have in our toolbox in primary care. So when would we consider using topical agents, and when should we not?
So there's lots of different topical agents, and online had patients who've searched all sorts of different topical agents. The ones commonly used here are a combination of local anesthetic and steroid agents, and they essentially help provide some analgesia and comfort around perianal conditions. Whilst they're marketed as hemorrhoid creams, they do not resolve the hemorrhoid. They don't necessarily have any vascular effect on those cushions or make them any smaller. They just help provide some analgesia and reduce some of the acute inflammation or irritation that may be there from either the prolapse or irritation from these. So I think they're a useful option for patients to try, but should be advised that this isn't a long-term fix for the hemorrhoids, and they can be used as required to help with discomfort if you feel that. But if your symptoms are predominantly related to internal hemorrhoids with bleeding, then topical agents aren't going to be useful for that. Whereas if they're more external and are bothersome of feeling the hemorrhoid, then they may provide some relief.
Great. Okay, thank you for clarifying that, which brings me on to my next question. What are the indicators for a primary care physician to refer on for specialist opinion? What patients do you want to see?
Sure. I think this is a very important question in primary care, because rectal bleeding or anorectal conditions are very common. It's a very common complaint for which people will present, and trying to tease out who may have something that's a bit more worrying and who needs to be referred on is very important. So we often talk about red flag symptoms or concerning symptoms when patients present, and these will be features on their history or examination or investigations that make it slightly higher risk of them having perhaps an underlying malignancy or a cause that's different to the common benign conditions for anorectal bleeding. So these would be things on history, such as blood that's mixed in with the stool or altered blood, rather than what we call outlet type bleeding, which is bright red blood on the paper or on the outside of the stool, particularly if that's associated with a change in bowel habit, and particularly if that's towards increased frequency or diarrhea, then that is a concerning feature on history. Isolated constipation as a change in bowel habit is very common. I'm sure we've all had periods of isolated constipation. It doesn't necessarily indicate something sinister if it's a brief period, but if it's a definite change in someone's bowel habit and it persists beyond several weeks, then that should also be investigated. Having significant abdominal pain as part of your history, particularly that persists for several weeks, is also an important thing. Weight loss, and that's unintentional weight loss that patients may be noticing amongst all of those, is quite an important feature. Family history of either colorectal malignancy or polyps, particularly in younger patients, so younger than 50, if there's a family history of such, then that's an important thing that raises the risk of something more significant underlying. And we often use age as an important stratification tool when someone presents with rectal bleeding. And at our practice, we often have an age cutoff of 45 with anyone who has persistent rectal bleeding over that age warrants investigation with either a colonoscopy or a CT colonography, because their risk of something different as a cause for their rectal bleeding is much higher. That doesn't mean people under the age of 45 don't get such problems. They also need to be assessed as a case-by-case basis with all those other features on history. So those would be very important things on history. On examination, as discussed, any concerns of the mass on rectal examination or on inspection of the perianal region, something that looks very different to what might be a simple skin tag. If there's concerns, this may be a squamous cell carcinoma or an atypical perianal lesion, then that should be referred for review. And on basic investigations, anyone with anemia, particularly an iron deficiency anemia, in the context of rectal bleeding or abdominal symptoms, should be further investigated.
Fantastic. Thank you. So our patients like to know what to expect when they see a specialist. It can be quite anxiety provoking. So can you just describe your approach to addressing these types of patients?
Sure. No, it can be quite a difficult topic for patients to discuss. They can be embarrassed to talk about it. They feel very awkward talking about things to do with their bottom or bleeding or to do with their bowel motions. So when they are referred to our clinic, I think the first thing is to establish some rapport, let them know that, look, this is a common thing and they're here in this clinic to get that reviewed, and that's what our specialty is. As with most things, it does start with a good history. So those things that I mentioned in terms of trying to stratify perhaps what their risk of something more significant underlying may be, and then history specific to their symptoms. And we were discussing hemorrhoids earlier, and people often will report anything around their bottom as hemorrhoids, be it skin tag, be it a rectal prolapse, be it a low rectal cancer that's prolapsing, can all be termed hemorrhoids by patients because that's all they can feel. So knowing exactly what their symptoms are, whether it's bleeding, whether it's pain, the frequency and nature of all of that is very important, because that also then dictates what you do as part of your management. You don't want to be treating all hemorrhoids if they're not necessarily causing the patient that significant a symptom. Following that, it's a examination, which, as I mentioned, starts with a good inspection of the perianal region, followed by a digital rectal examination, and then a rigid sigmoidoscopy to evaluate the mucosa of the rectum, followed by a proctoscopy to examine the anal canal more closely. And that, of course, also is combined with a general examination and an abdominal examination in the context of how they're presented. And following that, once there's a picture of what might be the underlying cause, is investigations. And that depends on what you suspect may be the underlying reason for their presentation. And that may involve a colonoscopy or a CT colonography to exonerate the proximal colon and ensure there's no other cause for the bleeding. It may also involve blood tests and checking your full blood count, iron studies, and in some cases, a plain CT if there's symptoms that are more concerning for other things that you want a quick screen for. So it does depend on your findings on history and examination as to the next step.
Harry, I wonder if I can just ask, please, you've mentioned colorectal cancer, which is something that we are all not wanting to ever miss. Are there certain populations that have a higher occurrence of colorectal cancer? So when we see someone walk through into our room, that our index of suspicion should be higher?
Yes, that's a good question. In fact, I think that's an important consideration when you are seeing a patient as to their ethnicity. We know from population studies here in New Zealand that Māori are overrepresented in cancer statistics overall, and that also stands true for colorectal cancer. They also have more acute presentations and present with more advanced stage colorectal malignancy, and there's several factors that contribute to that. Certainly, if someone is presenting to you with rectal bleeding and of Māori ethnicity, then that should also heighten your suspicion that there may be something more significant underlying. And referring for investigations such as colonoscopy or CT colonography or to surgical clinics would be appropriate in that regard. The National Bowel Screening Program in New Zealand starts at the age of 60, and there are discussions about perhaps reducing that to the age of 50, as it is in other places, including Australia, to recognise that as an important cutoff for age when the risk benefit is in favour of benefit. And perhaps we also need to treat ethnicity in the same regard, that it also heightens the risk in certain populations.
So just picking up on that point, if we're thinking over 45, you've mentioned generally, should we be thinking over 35, for example, in Māori, or do we just not have that data to support those sort of decisions yet?
I think we don't have that data to support it yet. I think if someone Māori ethnicity is 40 or older and presenting with these sorts of symptoms, then you should have a strong case to investigate that further. But we don't have any strong data to say that should be the age of 35, for example.
Okay. Right.
Younger onset colorectal cancer overall is recognized globally as an increasing phenomenon, and there's several reasons to that. And it tends to be left-sided cancers, so rectal, sigmoid, descending colon cancers. And so an adequate examination first in such patients, which involves a digital rectal examination and referral to surgical clinics where rigid sigmoidoscopy can be done, may help find out what the cause might be. But at this stage, we can't say that all Māori over 35 should have a colonoscopy for any bleeding symptoms. But certainly over the age of 40, with any of those other concerning symptoms, should warrant investigation.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. So we're going to move away now from hemorrhoids and touch on perianal hematoma. So this isn't something that we see as often in primary care, but it is equally important. So how do we go about thinking about these?
Sure. So perianal hematoma, again, just going back to anatomy and what I was discussing with regards to those anal cushions with hemorrhoids. We often talk about a internal hemorrhoidal plexus and an external hemorrhoidal plexus, or these two separate cluster of blood vessels, one more internally in the anal canal and one more externally towards the anal verge. A perianal hematoma is essentially a hematoma in that external hemorrhoidal plexus or a thrombose area in that vascular cushion. That will present usually as a very painful lump, and patients will describe sudden onset of a painful lump around the bottom. It may have been precipitated by an episode of straining or heavy lifting that caused increased pressure in that vascular cushion and led to the development of a hematoma. It then does lead to a visible swelling. And if you were to examine patients in that acute phase, it can be quite a tense marble-like swelling right at the anal verge, which is obvious if you retract the buttocks and seen externally. patients may well be too sore at that point to tolerate any digital rectal examination. And so the appearance of that, along with their history being a short history of a painful lump, is often enough to give you the diagnosis. The management depends on how soon after the onset of symptoms the patient has come to see you. Usually after the 48 to 72 hour mark, the patient starts to feel better, the pain starts to reduce as that acute swelling and inflammatory response starts to subside. If patients are presented to you beyond that 72 hour mark, then it's appropriate to manage it non-operatively with analgesia, topical treatments like the ones we discussed that have a steroid local anesthetic combination, or topical lignocaine gel, which provides an analgesic effect, the use of sitz baths if patients have a bath at home, or can use something similar, then using that to provide some comfort and relax the anal sphincter, which often can spasm in response to the pain. That would be appropriate in patients who present a bit later. Those who present sooner, in the first 24 to 48 hours, they're often in much more discomfort, and these patients can benefit from having a procedure in the clinic room where an incision is made over the hematoma and the hematoma evacuated. And this can provide quite immediate relief to patients, but it does mean that you either have to consider local anesthetic or a incision over the area, warning the patient that the incision itself is uncomfortable and painful, but it does lead to relief of that acute swelling. So those would be the overall principles with a perioral hematoma.
You mentioned a sitz bath. Can you just talk us through what that is?
Sure. So this is also quite a historic thing, where it's a bath that involves filling the bath or a tub with some shallow water, and it can be warm water or to the comfort of the patient, and enough to just dip the patient's buttocks and anus in the region to provide just some comfort and relief. People traditionally would put salts and other agents within the bath because it was felt to provide more relief, but literally the action of just a warm water bath to soak that area is adequate to relax some of the sphincter muscle and provide a bit of comfort through that. So it's a very simple measure that patients can use.
So moving on now to our final topic of anal fissures. These are very difficult to manage. I wonder if we could start firstly, though, by the clues that we would get from history and examination to make this diagnosis.
They are literally a pain in the bottom, and that's often how I start my explanation to this about anal fissures. So the clues on history, and I guess for us when we are considering anyone who presents with rectal bleeding and painful rectal bleeding, which is often a sharp, stinging or tearing type pain, is an anal fissure until proven otherwise. It's not always an anal fissure, and there's instances where it's other pathology, but that would be by and far the most common diagnosis. And often on history alone, you can diagnose an anal fissure if patients are telling you that. And it's often a recurrent and intermittent history. And patients will often say, when I'm a bit more constipated or have harder stool, I'll get these episodes of pain with bright blood on the paper when I wipe. And that tends to last a few days and things come right again. And that sort of pattern continues. They may also complain of a skin tag or some loose skin, which is often a sentinel tag outside or external to the area of the fissure, which is a common association with that. And patients often complain of skin tag the most without realizing that the true problem is the underlying fissure is the cause of the pain. And so examination for anal fissures does start from a good perianal examination and inspection. It does mean adequate exposure and retraction of the buttocks, actually looking at the anal verge and actively looking for the presence of a fissure, finding a skin tag or several skin tags, means you should adequately retract the area to see if there is perhaps sufficient underlying this towards the anal canal. And fissures most commonly are in the anterior posterior midline. However, patients may present with atypical fissures that are off the midline, particularly in patients with Crohn's disease or other pathology. But those would be important to pick up on inspection alone. Usually patients are in too much discomfort to tolerate a digital examination if they have a fissure. And if they are visibly in discomfort with retraction of the buttocks, or you can visibly see them spasming or clenching the buttocks, then that's usually a good indication that there is an underlying fissure or a painful perianal lesion as a cause for that.
So I mentioned that I found anal fissures difficult to manage. So I wonder if you can talk us through the recommended treatment options.
Yes, I think they are difficult to manage, including for colorectal surgeons. And the first step in treatment is similar to what we were discussing for hemorrhoids management. Again, focusing on lifestyle and dietary measures, aiming to get soft stool that patients do not have to strain to pass, do not have to sit on the toilet for long periods to pass, and therefore reducing the likelihood for excessive stretch of the anal sphincter and developing a tear as a result. So those would be increasing fiber, increasing fluid intake, ensuring regular physical exercise, and trying to have a regular soft bowel habit. Beyond that, for patients who need laxatives and other supplements, then that should be also utilized. And those can be either osmotic laxatives or stimulant laxatives, depending on what patients find useful to try and achieve that. Treatments specific for anal fissures then go to the topical sort of category, and primary care often rectogesic or GTN ointment, 0.2%, is commonly used. We prefer diltiazem paste, 2%, which is just as effective but has a lower risk of causing headaches, which is a common side effect of rectogesic ointment. And diltiazem paste is made up or compounded in a pharmacy and then should also be applied frequently, which is 3 times a day, for an adequate course of 4 to 6 weeks to achieve regular sphincter relaxation and thereby improve the chance of fissure healing. Essentially, you're trying to break the vicious cycle of sphincter spasm and poor blood supply to the region of the fissure and ongoing poor healing of the fissure by relaxing the sphincter muscle through these topical agents and allow the fissure to heal. If that's combined with the lifestyle and dietary measures, then there is a good majority of patients who can have their fissure symptoms and fissures well managed. Beyond that, in patients who still have a persistent fissure, despite those surgical options, these include procedures that require general anesthetic, such as injection of Botox into the sphincter complex, which has the same effect as the topical agents of relaxing the sphincter, but achieves it over a more durable period, and therefore it doesn't mean having to apply the cream all the time. However, if patients in a head-to-head fashion were to compare applying the cream adequately versus a single Botox injection, the outcomes would be the same. So depending on the patient's compliance, if they can do that well, they can achieve the same effect with topical therapy. Beyond that, patients may have persistent fissures despite topical and Botox injections. And then we have options of a lateral internal sphincterotomy, which includes division of the internal sphincter muscle to achieve a more permanent relaxation of the sphincter. And that obviously has the risks of altering continence by dividing some of the sphincter complex. However, it does have an excellent healing rate for anal fissures of 90% or more. offering this option is on a case-by-case basis and needs to be discussed thoroughly with the patient, what their baseline continence function is, and whether they've adequately tried all those other measures. And it would be, well, I'd be reluctant to offer that in female patients, particularly postpartum, who may already have concerns with sphincter function, and would push all the options before that, before considering a sphincterotomy. Certain cases can be amenable to advancement flaps. However, I wouldn't say that's done very commonly, but that can also be an option in patients that are appropriate who have necessarily what we call low pressure fissures.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So to conclude our podcast today, some take home messages for our listeners, please, Perry.
Yes, I think a couple of take home points. That list of concerning features or red flag symptoms and anyone who presents with rectal bleeding is important to consider in any patients. I think given it is such a common presentation and the majority of patients will have a benign cause to their bleeding symptoms, it's important to have such things within your mindset when trying to triage patients who should have investigations and those who can safely be managed in an outpatient or primary care setting. Hemorrhoids, anal fissures, perineal hematomas are all very common. Hemorrhoids can occur concurrently with other pathology, and therefore assessing for those other concerning features, even though all you see on examination is hemorrhoids, is still important and may still warrant further investigations. The other take-home points would be a good perianal examination and inspection, particularly looking for fissures, and anyone who presents with painful bleeding is important, and then starting some appropriate topical therapy, be it rectogesic or diltiazem paste, as a useful start, along with reinforcing all the lifestyle and dietary measures. And if patients aren't responding to any of those features, then a referral or specialist review or colorectal review is important.
Fantastic. And I'll just add in, if you have a Maori patient, have a higher index of suspicion for colorectal cancer. Thank you, Perry, for your time today. It's been wonderful talking to us.
Thanks very much, Louise, and thank you for this opportunity.
If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points for listening to this podcast, please log them. You'll also find a list of resources used in making this podcast on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thanks for joining us today.